Springer hits it hard down the left field line. It is gone. Man, an absolute rocket down the left field line. And that is the 50th leadoff home run for George Springer in his career.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to At the Letters, presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you in Toronto, Arden Zwelling in Kansas City to talk some Blue Jays today. We got a lot to get to in the course of the next couple of segments here, but Arden, how you doing out there in KC?
Good, man. Good. It's funny. I haven't been to KC in a while. I haven't seen the Royals up close in a while. Probably didn't realize how bad they are.
Right.
I haven't been watching a lot of Royals baseball, and it's always a reminder, right, when you see the Royals up close or the Orioles up close. What, it was 2015 that the Blue Jays played the Royals in the ALCS. It was 16 that the Blue Jays played the Orioles in the wild card game. So all three of these teams, Blue Jays, Orioles, Royals, were all competitive in 15-16, all started rebuilds immediately after that. And now the Blue Jays have very quickly come out of it, like, young, exciting team. They're 10 games above 500. Run differential looks a lot better right now. They're going to the postseason again, missed by a game last season. We're in it in 2020. And then you look at the Royals, worst team in baseball. And like Daniel Lynch is like getting teed off on, and Sal Perez looks really, really rough right now. And like Hunter Dozier is playing first base. You look at the Orioles, like, pretty self-explanatory how bad that team's been. It's, I know I make this point like 2 million times a season, but it's such a reminder that the Blue Jays rebuild and return to competitiveness has been so efficient and so quick. It's not always like this. If anything, the Blue Jays are the exception to the rule. Royals, Orioles started their rebuilds at the same time and are still very much in the depths of them.
That's right. Not necessarily painless, but definitely very quick for the Jays to emerge and be one of the better teams in the American League at this point. You know, you could throw the Tigers into that group as well. And the Jays, of course, will see them for the first time this coming weekend. They'll see the Orioles, too, for the first time next week. So they're going to have the chance, which is wild. I mean, that's going to be interesting. But they'll have the chance to face off against some lesser opposition. And I think your bigger point is interesting, Arden, because it highlights a couple of things the Jays have done really well. One being they've had star-level players come up from the minor leagues, like not just, you know, Bo and Vlad, but Kirk and Manoah. They have very, very good young players producing immediately, and that's massive. And they've also spent. I mean, to have George Springer, to have Ryu on this team, and we'll get to Ryu later in this podcast, but Springer's a massive, massive player for this team, and there's no George Springer equivalent suiting up for Baltimore. Like, they haven't made a free agent bid in years, so it does help things.
And you even look at some of the pitching talent deeper down in the minor leagues for the Blue Jays right now, and what some of the like guys like Frasso and Tiedemann and like, you know, Palmer are doing. And it's kind of like, it's not, there are those waves are there, right? Like, it's not like the Blue Jays have emptied their system to get here. Like, they still have a lot of upside talent in their system on the way up. You know, it's not like the Blue Jays just since 15 and 16 rebuilt their major league roster. Like, they've rebuilt a minor league system. They've built out a developmental system that didn't exist before. They've, you know, built out high performance, built out their front office and analytics. And they have all kinds of like models and statistical analysis and data that they didn't utilize before. So it's not even just the product that most Blue Jays fans see for 3 hours a night on Sportsnet. Like, it's all the stuff beneath the surface as well that is feeding up into that. There's been a ton of work that has been undertaken over the last 6-7 years here.
And they're a good team, really good team. I mean, last year they won 91 games. This year, one third of the way through the season exactly, they've won 32 games. So the math is easy. They're on pace for 96, which is great. It's more than 91. It's more than most teams in baseball will win this year. And of course, it's about 20 games less than what the Yankees were on pace to win. So, you know, it's not an easy place to be. Like, if your prize for winning, you know, at this kind of clip might honestly be a 3-game series against a pretty good team, like, I don't know, the Chicago White Sox or something.
That hit, when you put it like that, I was like, oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting it, man. Like, that has not changed over the last 6-7 years. It's the realities of playing in the American League East. That hasn't changed in my entire existence on this planet. The AL East has always been a dogfight for literally as long as I have been alive. So I don't know why that would ever change going forward. But like, look, it's the postseason, right? Like, you want to talk about like takes I've given 2 million times before on this podcast. Just get into the playoffs. Just get into the dance, baby, and see what happens. Like, it's a three-game series. Yes, like, that is a very small sample against probably a pretty good team. I mean, how different is it than a five-game series or a seven-game series? Really, it's still baseball, right? Like, those samples are not long enough to determine who is the better team overall. Like, that's why I always say, like, whoever has the most wins at the end of the regular season is the champion of baseball. Like, they should raise a banner, they should get a trophy, they should have a parade. And then the competition afterwards, the postseason, the playoffs, that's just a fun little tournament that you have for the best teams at the end of the year, and you see what happens and who's hot at that time, who's playing well at that time, who's healthy at that time. They get to, you know, go on a run in the tournament and win a trophy for the tournament. But like, the champion of baseball, the best baseball team, is the team that has the most wins at the end of the regular season. So the best baseball team is generally the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah, they certainly win their share of games. It's very random, but I do like how there's this contest that happens afterwards, because it informs so much about the way you rest players down the stretch. It informs so much about the kinds of players you acquire at the deadline. So I actually like that there's this random postseason tournament. We'll see how it plays this year, because, you know, if the Jays are swept in two games by, you know, an 82-80 Angels team, which, you know, they've lost 12 in a row right now, by the way, so maybe that's a stretch for them. But if the Jays get knocked out, I think we'll have a lot of our listeners who are really devastated, you know, of course, because this team, as if you were to trace it back to the previous format, they still probably would have made the playoffs. So they're not a team that probably would have needed that three-game format, at least for the 2022 season.
Yeah, but like, that could happen easily. The Blue Jays could lose the next two against Kansas City. They've played one against the Royals, right? And they won it rather handily. But I don't know, like, maybe Alek Manoah comes out of his start here on Tuesday because, like, I don't know, he hits a couple dudes and gets thrown out, or because suffers an injury or something like that. And, you know, Trent Thornton coughs up a bunch of runs, or like Matt Gage has to get extended and gives up some runs out of the bullpen, and the Blue Jays lose a tough one. And then Brady Singer shows up on Wednesday and has like the game of his life, goes like 8 shutty, and the Blue Jays, get one run in the ninth, but they coughed up two and they lose 2-1, right? Like, those things could totally happen. So like, you could lose two games in a row to a really bad team like the Royals just as easily as you could lose two games in a row in the postseason to a Chicago White Sox. So that's baseball, man. Like, two games, anything can happen. That's why, like, the playoffs, just enjoy it. It's a ride. It's the NCAA tournament. Crazy stuff goes on. Just enjoy it for what it is. Win the regular season. That's how you're the best baseball team.
And the Jays still have a chance to do that, to be fair. I mean, I know the Yankees are up 7 games, but to me, this is in play for them. The Yankees are not going to play at this pace the entire season. They are not going to have, you know, Cortes and Severino and Cole playing this well. Something is going to go wrong for them. And that's not really happened so far this year for the New York Yankees. So that will give the Jays the chance to gain, especially when you pair that with where the Blue Jays are at with respect to their schedule. This division is in play, and then therefore a first-round bye is in play. A lot of things can happen. We have two-thirds of the season left to go. But, you know, I guess I want to kind of start here, Arden, with the offense, because Teoscar, Vladdy, Bo, we've talked at times this season about struggles for these guys, but they've taken steps, they've taken strides toward better plate appearances, better contact. What are you seeing right now from the heart of the Jays order? Because that was really supposed to be the core of this team and the driving force behind it.
It's funny. Like, I just went on Fangraphs. I set the split to last 14 days. And there is only one Blue Jays hitter over the last 14 days. No qualifiers. Minimum plate appearance is zero. Only one hitter has a Wade Runs Created Plus below 115.
Wow.
Bradley Zimmer.
I was going to guess. Yeah.
That's the only guy, and he's only been to the plate 15 times in the last two weeks, right? So he's like barely hitting, right? And because he's not producing. But literally everyone else who has made a plate appearance, 115 Wade Runs Created Plus or higher. Like, it's wild, right? But like, look, what were we saying for the first 6, 7, 8 weeks of the season when the Blue Jays were slumping and not putting together offensively? They'll come around. You bet on the track records. You bet on the talent. You bet on the exit velos, how hard they're hitting the ball. You bet on the swing decisions, stuff like that. Like, there are reasons to believe that something like this will happen. But even in that moment, I was like, well, is the regression all going to hit like a freaking tidal wave, right? Is it all going to come at once? Like, surely it'll be sort of a slow thing. And maybe we have to adjust to actually our season long expectations a little bit. And certain guys won't actually be, you know, what they've been in the past. Maybe they'll be a little bit below. No. It all came at once. Like, okay, I guess this stuff is just already like set in stone, right? Like, I guess like this is not a deterministic world, like, or this is a deterministic world. Like, this is, we do not have free will. Like, it is just all gonna happen the way it's gonna happen. Like, don't even, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters, because it's just like the numbers are gonna come back around and they're all gonna come like at once. That's what we've seen so far. It's kind of wild.
Well, yeah, I'll leave it to smarter minds than mine to determine whether we have free will or not. But certainly the offense.
I'm saying it doesn't.
I heard your take. I think it's impressive. It's impressive. And whatever force of nature is driving this offensive surge behind the Jays, they'll take it. They needed this. I mean, it was rough for times there, which is weird because they're the Toronto Blue Jays and we expect them to hit, but that is really interesting that all those guys are hitting right now. And of course, it does add up with the eye test, because we've seen Tapia's best at-bats of the season. We've seen Biggio come around a little bit. Espinal, of course, Kirk. I mean, we talked about Kirk and Jansen in the last podcast. And since then, it's like Kirk has gone even better. So it really is a full team effort. And to see, to me, the guy that I was waiting, well, the two guys that I was waiting for were Vladdy and Teo. And then when Vladdy, you know, to have four homers in the last six games, that is, I mean, it's tough to do a lot better than that. That's an encouraging sign for the Jays.
As Vladdy sends one to right center field. Oh, boy. Wow. A rocket to right center for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Hey, and don't look now, but Vladdy is starting to heat up. Home runs come in bunches.
And like opposite field homers, the line drive homers, crushing his pitch homers, and then also sometimes hitting the pitch that's like in up off the plate that every other hitter on the planet like fouls off, or like, you know, gets that sting in their hands and has to like walk it off. Vlad just like hits that one over the fence incredibly. Sometimes I wonder if he like feels things in his hands, you know, because he's like tattooing balls like below the label on his bat. And it's like, what? Does that not hurt like hell to do that? He's getting, remember the three homer game in New York? What happened earlier in that game? He got spiked, like literal spike into flesh, required three stitches after the game. Gnarly, gnarly scenes. And he is still able to like swing a bat with enough force to take Garrett Cole deep and to hit three home runs in a game. Like, it's just kind of incredible the things that he does. But yeah, good to see him coming around. Like Matt Chapman starting to come around, one of the unluckiest players in baseball. If you look at the expected stats and you look at the exit velos and how hard he puts the ball in play consistently. So, I mean, that's been a little bit under the radar because like there's been so many good offensive stories lately. And then I think as a collective, like you're just seeing a lot more discipline at the plate maybe than there was earlier in the year. And I always thought like the Blue Jays were making okay swing decisions, certain guys better than others, but it really has seemed like collectively, you know, each player has taken a really like patient and like professional approach to the plate in each of their plate appearances. And like, I still have it open last 14 days on FanGraphs for the Blue Jays. And I'm seeing a lot of walk rates in the double digits, right? And like one of the lower ones is Bo Bichette at 8.8%, which is like great for Bo Bichette, you know. It's Tapia at 7.1 is great for Raimel Tapia. So, and everybody else is like double digits and well into the double digits too. So that's been pretty big. And I think that's part approach collectively. Cecil, part seeing some easier pitching than the Blue Jays had earlier in the year when it was like every time out, here's, you know, another guy who throws 98, 99 with a wicked slider.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like you said, Garrett Cole in that early game for Vladdy, like they faced a ton of really difficult pitching. That'll shift. I mean, they're going to face, Royals, Tigers, Orioles. That's a pretty good slate of games. And of course, you know, there are no gimmies in baseball, but that's a good chance for them to kind of continue this run. And if they do that and they kind of find their level offensively, then you got to think that can kind of let these guys settle in, because I do think there was a fair amount of pressure, and that pressure isn't going to go anywhere. For them to win the World Series, for them to win the division title, they're going to face a lot of pressure in the course of the next 4 or 5 months. But you don't want to feel that at bat to at bat. And I think it can inform some of those swing decisions for someone like a Vladdy, where he's not trying to put the team on his back. And if he knows that Teoscar is finally hitting and Chapman is finding, you know, more barrels and more outfield grass with his hits, then it might ease the pressure for them as a group and lead to, I mean, we saw it all last year, what this team can do when they're healthy.
Yeah, and you look around the roster, right? You can maybe, like, you know, nitpick at the edges, right? And you could say, oh, okay, well, you know, like, meritocratically, should Nathan Lucas be here over Bradley Zimmer? Like, yeah, maybe you can make that move. Or do you want to, like, what we talked about last time out, do you want to condense Zimmer and Tapia into one with, like, yes, Tyler Naquin or whatever, Gamble or whatever, whoever, pick your guy, right? Benintendi, whoever. Yeah, you could, like, pick that nit. But of, like, everyday players, like, players who are getting consistent regular playing time, like, who are you really looking to upgrade on right now? Like, who, like, there isn't really, like, one roster hole in terms of, like, your everyday guys. And part of that is health, right? Everybody's healthy right now, so you're not having, like, a Zimmer forced into everyday playing time. Like, you know, you can use Biggio more strategically and use him to get certain guys days off and, you know, use him in matchups where he's likely to have success. But, like, you look at a lineup of, like, Springer, Bichette, Guerrero, Hernandez, Jansen / Kirk, Chapman, Espinal, Gurriel. I don't know who you'd really be looking to upgrade on position player-wise right now.
Yeah, I do think, like, as when we've talked about this now for weeks, yeah, you're certainly right that there's no individual there that you're trying to upgrade on, especially now that Lourdes is hitting as well. But if you did find a way to get that lefty power bat, like, I'm almost just even thinking as far as, okay, when you're, let's say they're in the playoffs, let's say they're facing whoever it is, I don't know, the Angels, for example, in a 3-game playoff series. Well, if they know that you have a good lefty power hitter on your bench, okay, that informs their roster decision. So maybe they're taking a second lefty along with Aaron Loop, and then that takes one roster spot away from them where they might otherwise have carried a pinch hitter, or they might carry an extra arm in the bullpen that would give Joe Maddon some breathing room. So, you know, I think that even just having that threat can do some different things. And you're not going to, you know, that's a very precise situation. You're not going to manage your roster to that very precise situation. But I think, and certainly, like, we're getting to the point of nitpicking, but that's the wish list, I guess. If, you know, if there is someone that's, I don't know, is it a Robbie Grossman? Is there, do you bring Corey Dickerson back now that the Cardinals have some more position players who are doing pretty well? So there are different things to look at in that vein.
Yeah, and if you could get that individual to be a guy who can play center, you know, and hits left and can run a bit, like, yeah, even great, right? Like, how many boxes can you check with, like, that one individual, right? Like, but I don't know if that guy exists. Like, it probably has to be, like, a Brian Reynolds plus Josh Bell or something like that, right? And then now you're having to subtract quite a bit from your bench. And, like, Reynolds could, like, condense, like, Tappy Zimmer into one, and then, yeah, I don't know, in the playoffs, like, you can carry an extra position player anyway, and down the stretch in September you can anyway, but you still gotta get through August with these guys that you've, you know, that you've added, and you still only have 26 man rosters, so might be some uncomfortable juggling there, or somebody has to get optioned to Buffalo who maybe, like, is playing well, but they just have options, so just from a roster management standpoint, they gotta go, but ultimately, by that point, somebody's gonna be hurt anyway, so it's just one of those things that's gonna sort itself out.
Yes, you can lock that in. Well, things are good on the offensive side for the Blue Jays. They do have some more questions on the pitching side, so when we come back on At the Letters, we will look at their pitching staff. Welcome back to At the Letters, and it's now time for Keeping It Light, presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Now, Jays, at this point in the season, we're into the month of June, about 1 month away before the All-Star game, and so it's time to start looking around at some of these candidates. And of course, we know Vladdy and Bo and George Springer. I mean, they have strong candidacies for the All-Star game, Arden, but, you know, they also have some first-time All-Star candidates. So who among this Blue Jays group, who on this Blue Jays roster strikes you as someone who has a shot to go to Los Angeles, play at Dodger Stadium as a first-time All-Star representing this team?
I think Jordan Romano is going to go. He's got the counting stats that everybody loves, right? Plenty of saves. He's obviously having a tremendous season, and I think that just as a pitcher, it's a lot easier to kind of sneak into those onto those rosters, right? Because you're always having replacements, and there's more pitchers that go. So, yeah, I think Jordan Romano goes to the All-Star game.
I like it. I mean, they actually have a few candidates. I think Manoah's going. It would be hard to deny Manoah at this point. And I think Kirk's got a pretty good chance. Like Manoah and Romano, I think like they almost, the way things look now, and of course there's still 5 weeks to go, but the way things look now, those guys probably should be going. And I think Kirk, with another few good weeks, like it would be really hard to deny him just the kind of season that he's had as well.
Fly ball left. Well hit. How about Alejandro Kirk? He does it again.
Yeah, just look at Jordan Romano. He hasn't pitched in June. We are now, so this is a total aside, but I just had his page up here. It's June 7th. We're recording this. He has not pitched this month. I think Jordan Romano is going to pitch tonight. We're recording this on Tuesday, even just to get some work. Because, like, I know we went through the whole they're using Jordan Romano too much thing. Now they're, like, not using him enough. So he's got to get into a game here soon.
Well, it will certainly help the All-Star bid if and when he does. But it's also, I kind of like that they found him a little bit of a sneaky week off there, because after going 3 in a row, and if I'm not mistaken, he might have gone 4 of 6 in there at one point. That's a lot of usage. That's a heavy toll on the arm. So for him to be able to just get a little bit of a breather is probably a good thing for the long-term health of the arm.
He pitched on the 26th, 27th, 28th of May. He was down on the 29th and 30th, and he pitched on the 31st.
Yeah.
So that would be 4 of 7, I believe. Yeah,
that's a busy week.
He was working a lot. Oh yeah, and they were like stressful innings as well, right? But like that's kind of part of the role as a closer. Like they're pretty much all stressful innings. But you know, I think about the one in LA in particular when Ross Stripling had to like parachute in and get that final out. Romano's velocity was down. He was out there for third day, given everything that he had, he just didn't have enough to give to get through that outing. You don't want to see situations like that. So yeah, no, I agree with you. It's good that the Blue Jays almost like stole him this little like mini, it's like IL stint almost, right? Like
exactly.
He just hasn't pitched in a week.
Yeah, it's an IL stint that's not an IL stint, but that's good. Pitchers need rest. I mean, they should have breaks in the course of a season. You're not going to go out there and pitch 4 or 6 games all year and have anything left in October. So that's a good thing. But you mentioned Stripling there, and in that game against the Angels, he's coming in as a closer.
The 0-2. Ground ball chopped up the first baseline. Stripling lays a tag. That's going to do it. And a smile from Stripling. A dangerous little roller up the first baseline and lays the tag on Velazquez.
Then we see him in Kansas City pitching 5 shutout innings against the Royals. But, he's someone who is, as we've talked about, very versatile. He's actually done a really good job as a starting pitcher. And the results, if you look back at them in the course of the last year or so, have been pretty consistent and pretty good. And I mean, at this point, one presumes that's his spot to run with.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me, Ross Stripling, and I wrote about him on Monday night, like he's so valuable to a team, right? For his flexibility, for his resourcefulness, the fact that over the last month we've seen him in the rotation, making starts every 5-6 days, pitching mop-up duty, getting high leverage 1-inning stints, coming in to bail Jordan Romano out of a spot, and then now back into the rotation. Like, good luck having a routine, having any kind of rhythm. Like, and it's, shout out Dan Schulman, who always says this, and I know you're listening, Dan, and I actually stole this in my piece last night, so thanks for that one. See you at the ballpark later today. His gift is his curse, right? Like, and it's that flexibility, and it's that resourcefulness, because like anytime he gets on a roll in the rotation, like meritocratically, he should be this team's 5th starter over Hyunjin Ryu when Hyunjin Ryu is healthy. But Hyunjin Ryu cannot oscillate between relief and starting as easily as Ross Stripling can, like as we just mentioned. So like his gift, what makes him so great in MLB, is also the curse. Like think about it this way. Like there's an alternate universe where for the last, what's it, 6 years now he's been in the big leagues, something like that. He's about to be a free agent, so six plus, right? Six and a half, where he's not pitching for competitive teams with deep rotations like the Dodgers and Blue Jays. So say he's pitching for like the Diamondbacks, right? Who just went and like pillaged Dallas Keuchel off of waivers, right? Or he's, you know, whatever, like the Angels who've been searching for pitching forever. And Ross Stripling is just like back end capable starter the whole way, starter whole way though, right? So like 150 innings a year, league average ERAs, like 1-2 win, you know, war sort of deal. If he hits free agency after that, he's looking at like the deal that Alex Cobb got from the Orioles, right? Remember a few years ago when Alex Cobb got like 4 years, $55 million? Ross Stripling could be looking at that as like a serviceable back end starter who doesn't throw particularly hard, but has a bunch of pitches and ways to get people out and to avoid barrels. But because he's been a swingman, like because he's been like Brad Peacock, who was literally his comp in arbitration this past year, he has made less money through arbitration each time through, and he's likely going to see less money on the open market as a free agent because he hasn't profiled as a back end starter, which he is totally capable of doing. Right now, he's got to be the best sixth starter, quote unquote, in baseball. This guy is totally capable of holding down a rotation job, but because he is so good as a swingman and so flexible, and it's so easy for him to go back and forth between the two roles, and also he has so little ego about it and is so accepting of the role and his buy into it is so much, it's actually costing him money as a professional by being so valuable and such an asset in that role.
And just the fate too of being, was he, I want to say he was drafted by the Dodgers. He certainly debuted with them. So, you know, like in a way.
Yeah, he had no say.
Yeah.
No choice.
There's no say, right? So, you know, drafted out of college too. So it's not like he's a high schooler and you're going to have this leverage and okay, you go back into the draft and, you know, you almost hope to be drafted by Cincinnati or Arizona or something. But yeah, drafted by the Dodgers, that is a tough one. That definitely would impact earning potential. And then Jays too, that's a tough place to get some innings the last couple of years since he's been here. And yeah, arbitration absolutely rewards innings, starts, saves. Those are the stats you want if you're going into arbitration. You know, historically it was wins, now it's less that, but it's still, you have to show up and you have to be in those games. And if you're in the bullpen for 8 days at a time, which he has been at stretches this year, just kind of sitting there idle waiting, mm-hmm. like we'll see him at times in the bullpen in Rogers Center, just like getting some work in because he hasn't pitched in a while. So it's a thankless job, and he's capable to do it. And he's someone who can pitch and he can work his way through a lineup. If you're Aaron Judge, seeing him for the second time in a week, I mean, you're probably not feeling great about that matchup if you're the Jays. But if you're going cycling through Royals and Tigers and just getting you through the grind of 162, mix in some Yankees, that's fine. He's not going to be fazed by the Yankees. Mix in some Red Sox. He can handle these different lineups, run them through a couple times, and then boom, you've probably got four or five innings.
So that versatility and that resourcefulness, like that applies to how he approaches hitters like Aaron Judge as well, right? Because like Ross Stripling's not going to outstuff Aaron Judge.
Oh, and right? He knows like, that.
Yeah, and Ross Stripling's very aware of that, right? So what does he do? He varies his sequencing, right? And he attacks them differently each time. And he thinks about his patterning and he thinks about like what the one weakness the Blue Jays believe Aaron Judge has in his swing is. And he thinks about how can I like most optimally attack that. And just look at like any Ross Stripling outing this year, and it is like almost an even mix of fastballs, sliders, changeups, curveballs for strikes. He's throwing a new sinker this year that is sneaking under bats, that's like 90 with like a little bit of movement. Fastball stays up, curveball comes down, sliders going left, changeups going right, sinkers like sneaking under barrels, like I said. And he's mixing and matching with all his pitches and throwing all of them for strikes. So like as a hitter, like how do you game plan for a guy who's got five pitches he can throw for strikes? Like you can't eliminate anything from the arsenal and you can't guess. So even if like the stuff is underwhelming metric wise, Ross Stripling throws so much of it and varies it so much, can sequence so differently, that it is like tough as a hitter to square him up, because it doesn't take that much to move a ball just off a barrel. Like look at the way that Ross Stripling's fastball at 92-93 plays in the zone on the plate, it plays really well because hitters are like thinking slider, thinking changeup, thinking sinker, like thinking about like all these other things, thinking about the curveball that Ross Stripling will throw with huge break and just drop on the plate for a strike. Look how many first pitch curveball for a strike Ross Stripling has, and look how often he uses a curveball to get himself back into counts. His primary out pitch this year has been his changeup. It was his curveball his whole career, and this year he's using his changeup out of the zone to get swing and miss. Like, he just kind of keeps reinventing himself, like start to start, month to month, year to year. He's always kind of like a different guy when Aaron Judge faces him. So it is like, so I do kind of think he could hold down that back end rotation spot. I'm not saying he's going to be like Alec Manoah, but I am saying like he could be 150 innings a year, league average ERA, like two and a half win type of guy if given that opportunity to really run with the rotation job.
Agreed. I think that's possible for sure. And, you know, it's interesting too, just kind of building on that point, he talks about when he's attacking hitters, he goes to their weakness. He's not pitching to his strength. He goes to their weakness, which is not what a lot of pitchers do. And what you're saying reminded me as you were speaking there of the contrast to Kevin Gausman. And, you know, Gausman on the weekend, there is some talk, you know, is he tipping? What's going on there? Well, you know, with Gausman, he has nasty stuff. I mean, the splitter and the fat, they're just outrageous pitches, both of them. But at the same time, if you know on an 0-2 count that he's going to throw a strike-to-ball splitter, even, we saw Palacios, the nine-hitter, on the Twins, standing there very comfortably just looking at a splitter. So whether Gausman was tipping with something with his body language or whether it's just his sequencing and his decision-making that makes him at times a little bit predictable, you do end up with a real contrast there to someone like Stripling.
That's an interesting discussion, right? Like, is Kevin Gausman tipping, or is he just pitching the same way he has all year? Fastballs up, splitters down, splitter way more often than not is a ball, right? And could Kevin Gausman benefit from using his fastball more down in the zone so it isn't only up,
right?
And throwing his splitter more often for a strike so the hitters can't just say, oh, it's down, probably a splitter, probably going to be a ball, I'm not going to swing. Oh, it's up, probably going to be a fastball, I'm going to swing at that because I'd rather try to square up his fastball, even though it's 96, 97, than try to hit the splitter, which is just going to freaking drop right below my bat. So it's possible that he's been tipping. I also think it's kind of possible that like his pattern, like the book's out. he's just using the same patterns and that maybe he needs to make a little adjustment there. But that's the thing, when you're Kevin Gausman, he has the slider as well. He has the changeup. I wonder if he can start using those a bit more often. Like, that's the benefit when you're Ross Stripling. It's like, yeah, I got five pitches, I'll throw for a strike. So like, okay, I started you. Am I going like two seam changeup too often? Okay, I'm going to go friggin' two seam heater this time, or I'm going to go two seam slider this time. Or actually, I started you with a two seam the last two times, I'm going to start you with a curveball this time. Like, Ross Stripling has so many more, you know, sequencing avenues he can go. With Kevin Gausman, when you are, you know, essentially relying a lot of time on just two pitches, it's like fastball splitter, or is it splitter fastball? Is it fastball fastball? Is it splitter splitter? Right? Like, I do wonder if maybe Kevin Gausman needs to start incorporating the slider a bit more often and the changeup, and also just using that fastball down in the zone more often and getting that splitter in for strikes more often. I know it's easy for me to sit here and say that, but I do think he could benefit from varying his sequencing a little bit.
Yeah, some more variation in some way. And I think, you know, I like the heavy fastball, heavy splitter usage from Gausman. I wonder about just, yeah, lowering the fastball periodically. And of course, you're going to use the third and fourth pitches at times as well. But, you know, let's get to Jose Berríos here as well, Arden, before you have to run to the ballpark and set up for coverage for the Tuesday night game here. Berríos, I mean, we talked about him last time. We were talking about the level of concern. And quite honestly, I think we both were pretty concerned. And if there was one start that could have erased a bunch of it, he certainly put it together on the weekend, striking out 13 hitters against his former team. I mean, he had swing and miss stuff. It looked really good. It looked really good. And so, you know, I hate to sit here and just kind of like flip-flop back and forth based on one start. But as any individual start can go, a 13 strikeout performance, I mean, that's about as much as you can move the needle in the other direction.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And you probably need to see it again, right? Because, like, we saw him really good against the Cardinals, saw him really good against the Mariners, and then he came out against the Angels. And, like, just that's where a lot of the concern came from because, like, the stuff was not there. The velo was not there. And for a lot of the season, I think he's just been, like, in bad places on the plate with his fastball, with his curveball sometimes, too. Like, he's just been missing on the plate too much. So, like, full credit to him, to Pete Walker, to Matt Bushman for making those adjustments so quickly. You know, basically just outing to outing, right? So, like, yeah, you got to eat a little bit of crow there for sure, because I was like, wow, like, I, you know, this is concerning what we're seeing from Jose Berríos through 10 starts. And then he goes out and has his best start of the season, one of the, you know, best starts he's had in some time. And he's had a really, really strong career. So, you know, you wonder about, was he a little fatigued going into that Angels outing? Was there, you know, I think the Blue Jays tweaked some things with his throwing program and his lifting between starts. Like, seems like that had an immediate benefit. So maybe there's something to be learned going forward, just about the volume and the workload in between outings that Jose Berríos is putting up. You know, and I think that, like, a lot of it for him is sequencing as well. Honestly, it's kind of like it's Gosman-esque and Stripling-esque as well. It's just like, how is he getting in to leverage counts? Like, what, you know, are hitters able to kind of see the fastball well on the plate? Like, what parts of the zone is he working to? You know, it's a, you want your fastball in the zone. Like, you want your fastball on the plate, four seamer, two seamer, for sure. You want to be throwing those for strikes, but where on the plate? Like, you need to put them in better spots than Jose Berríos was. And I know the Blue Jays have done some stuff with moving them on the mound, and you know, I don't know if there's anything mechanical there, but they've definitely been kind of tinkering a little bit with how he's going to be using his fastballs in the zone. And I think that they think that there's, you know, they that he can be better going forward. You know, I think they could probably tweak the catcher setup a little bit too, and just get him using better lanes and tunneling a little bit better with his curveball, which is still nasty, off of his heater, and vice versa. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things, a lot of tinkering that's going on there, and a lot of, you know, machinations. But the results for Jose Berríos' last time out, yeah, the Blue Jays will take that anytime that they can get it. It's like you said it perfectly. That was as much of a, like, shut the hell up about me, I'm fine outing as a guy can have.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, if he goes out there in his next start and he stops missing bats once again, well, it'll be time to adjust again, because, you know, you need to miss bats in this league, and he wasn't doing enough of it. So it'll be something worth watching as we continue into the middle part of the season here. Arden, thanks for all the insights today as we wrap up here on At the Letters, which of course is presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. We'll be back next week with more from whatever's going on with the Blue Jays. In the meantime, have a great week. And for Arden Zwelling, for producers Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade, I am Ben Nicholson-Smith, and thanks for listening.